This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So what we're going to do now is talk about one of the projects that this group of fellows were the core people in organizing. This was a project that was brought to us by Robert Williams. Robert Williams came to Mildred's Lane years before and was very, very interested in his work. He's a sculptor. He's from Lancaster, England. And his work, the core of his work, is really about issues of alchemy, looking at alchemy as a symbolic system for understanding, and looking at the goal of the historic alchemist as obtaining a conversation with God through material things and through images. So Robert always had a sort of notion of what would happen if in the early days of American European settlement, an alchemist makes their way from Europe into America and establishes an alchemical base in the Pennsylvania woods. What would become the Pennsylvania woods? So his notion was to build this ideal alchemical place, a very small building which was all built on the proportions and the precise construction methods of an alchemical endeavor. Should we go ahead?
Yeah, do you want to do introductions?
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. So these are the fellows who are part of the Alchemy Project. They're all going to introduce themselves.
I'm Catherine Cornelius, and I live in Washington, D.C., and my work is largely performance and video with some institutional critique and knowledge construction interests. So I came to this project because of the alchemy topic and the exploration of epistemology.
My name is Ashlyn Pentecost Farron, and I'm a curator, but I'm a history and anthropology curator, not an art curator. But I came to this because I'm interested in investigating how the strengths of the original museums could be brought back into museums today. And so I was drawn to Mark Dion's work and the kind of object investigations that we did to build the alchemist shack.
My name is Joseph Cruz. I'm originally from California, but I currently reside in Chicago. I go to the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. I'm an interdisciplinary artist working namely in installation and sound, basically exploring forms of production and reception of information.
Hi, my name is Matt Patin. I'm a printmaker and a painter coming from Baltimore, Maryland, and currently co-curating in Baltimore's Open Space Gallery, and I came to the project, I guess, mostly just from the topic of, you know, the alchemist shack.
Hi, my name is John Wanzel, and I am currently at Parsons, and I am a sculptor and photographer, and the interest of both alchemy and things brought me to Mildred's Lane.
I'm Brian Wilson. I live in New York City. I work as an artist and fabricator, and I work a lot with difficult materials.
So this is not the entirety of the group, but this is certainly a very core part of that group. Not everyone could be with us tonight. People do live in different places. And anyway, I want to say that Rob came over with a very, very coordinated program of what he wanted to do, which days he wanted to do it, how it should proceed. This program was defeated by an incredibly wet Pennsylvania summer. Nevertheless, the scholarly part of that program was very much enacted upon. And so we did spend a lot of time reading, looking at things, discussing art. Shall we start this?
I guess I'll start with a written quote from Robert that just basically kind of sums up the project's goals initially. This project will entail building a vernacular structure and the installation of a work that explores the relationship between a poetic language used in alchemical literature and that of contemporary discourses in science and cultural practices. This project will provide an opportunity to extend contemporary debates into the relationship between art and science as human inquiry and the construction of epistemological structures on an international stage between Lancaster, England, where Robert's from, and rural Pennsylvania, Mildred's Lane. It also offers a critical context to discourse about institutions, belief, and curiosity through collecting and tableau that will emerge during this session. I think a major part of the discourse was kind of looking at an alchemist as an esoteric inquiry between the sciences and the artists and the arts, and so a lot of the you know this entire session is very, very immersive. The entire time we're having fun, laughing, but we're really focused on these conversations, and so I guess Catherine will.
Well, this what you see right here is one of Robert's, preliminary studies for the work. It has a kind of assembly of different materials that the alchemist would have used or he would have had around him, kind of natural objects and things that he would combine to do actually the processes of alchemy, which we'll speak more about a little bit later. And here's another one of his initial, prototype thing.
Physical sketch.
Yeah, physical sketch. There you go. Something like this is planned for inside the alchemist's shack when it is completed. We're deterred, but only temporarily. If someone else wants to kind of join in with me, what we have here is the...
So this is a model of the actual inside of the house, and part of with being alchemy is part of it is as above, so below. So within this construction, below the mattress that people sleep on, of course, are the king and queen as represented in alchemy, as above, so below, in a missionary position. And there's a lot of symbols that are part of this that I think the other slides have some, as well as research material goes.
So I'll jump in about this. I came to Mildred's Lane coming out of the RISD glass department, and I came in, I brought a lot of, this is a little awkward, bringing these kind of pieces of glass here from the RISD glass department that had been hand blown by the students there. And they're all kind of based upon traditional alchemical vessels, alchemical distillation devices that would be used, and eventually they're going to be installed inside of the alchemist shack.
So some years before, Rob had done a seminar at RISD looking at the history of these shapes in using alchemical illustrations, and then with the glass department actually recreated these shapes.
And just to talk a bit about the other objects on the table, one of the things that we were able to do from time to time was leave Mildred's Lane and go on expeditions, sometimes just to get beer, but this one in particular took us to the Scranton Flea Market, which is a favorite hunting ground of Mark Dion, and we found some materials that we thought would help represent the sort of material culture around the alchemist that could then help create that environment once installed inside the shack. So some of these items, like we actually found a pair of the spectacles that were similar to the ones in that first slide that Robert had in his model for the shack. This is just a collection of everything that will be installed in that space.
And this is during one of the very exciting seminars that we had about sculpture, and Robert led a class, basically a short course around the history of sculpture and the development of things in the world to what we call contemporary sculpture, starting, of course, with ancient Greek, going through the expanded field into this kind of objecthood that we have today, where things have almost a magical quantity of being sculptural.
You can tell it's Robert because he's dressed all in black.
So at this point, we were confronted with the problem that we weren't actually physically going to be able to make this structure. and our friends from Cabinet Magazine, Sina and Graham, approached me with this idea that they would pay us $999, in which we would use that money to create for them something like a curiosity cabinet.
But all of the $999 was required to be spent on eBay, with the intention that eBay is kind of the modern day Curiosity Bazaar, whereas before, when curiosity cabinets were really popular during kind of the Enlightenment era, you would maybe go down to the docks or go to a special curiosity shop that sourced the special shell or feather you were looking for. eBay is now the place where you go if you're looking for something really weird. So Cabinet wanted us, and we'll actually invite a succession of artists to kind of interact with this idea that to create a kind of the true modern curiosity cabinet, you would go through the internet and you would kind of talk with people from all over the world, just like the owners of the original cabinets did, but you know, through the internet, through weird anonymous emails, reading their kind of misspelled descriptions of what they think they have in their jar. We had this one guy who was selling a ghost essence in a ragu jar. We unfortunately lost the bid, but anyway, it's the intention was a cabinet of curiosities from eBay.
And so what Robert and Mark and we decided was to use the Seven Doors of Alchemy as put forth by a person's name who I don't remember. And these are them here as ways of purifying both thought and material. So we have calcination, fixation, solution, distillation, sublimation, separation and projection. And then when we look at the installation out front, you'll see there are actually seven places going from bottom to top in the form of an athanor, which is an alchemist's oven.
It should also be noted that all these categories are kind of loosely interpreted in certain circumstances. Certainly distillation and sublimation and separation can be very kind of literally, you know, translated into the separation, sublimation, or distillation of materials. And something like projection became kind of an open-ended topic where it became, you know, projections of persona, projections of literal projections like the projector on the top of the piece.
So we hop through this slide. This is just a drawing of 18th century alchemical vessels, the processes in the alchemist world. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think with this slide, we're kind of reviewing items that we are interested in purchasing. And I mean, with eBay, one of the difficulties, but also one of the great things about it, is that there are literally millions of items available for us to kind of look for. And once we had the seven processes defined, we were just kind of trying to find physical representations of those items. But with there being so many, we were trying to kind of sort through the lead to find the gold in that.
And we had separated into different teams for each one of the seven processes to kind of help organize the labor around it. So we were checking our eBay bids and preparing meals like we do every day and participating in lectures and doing other activities around Mildred's Lane, all while preparing this eBay project.
Which sometimes someone's phone alarm would go off and we would go, oh no, there's a deadline, and so we'd stop the middle of this, you know, exciting discourse to just run over and give a big high five like you see in that image right there. It actually was quite exciting, especially when you're, you know.
Do you remember what we won at this moment? But I know that we won something that we were
It might have been the projector.
It was either the projector, or maybe it might have been the dragon skull that's out there as well.
It was the tortoise penis.
It could have been the raccoon penis bone.
But I mean, I think that was one of the fun parts, was just, you know, we had to really fight to get some of these items and invest the time to, you know, once we had found something we wanted and thought was an excellent addition to the cabinet, we actually had to make sure we got it. As was mentioned earlier, there was a ghost essence in a ragu jar that I think we all kind of wish we had, but You know, somebody wanted to pay $15, and we just didn't.
And I remember, Matt, you were very strict that you didn't want to pay more than like $8.50 for that.
There's a dollar 50 cent shipping as well. And I actually would say that that was one of the fun things about this project was the $999 also included the shipping and handling of these items. So while I think we got 10 pounds of salt for you know, a few dollars, it took a fair amount of money just to get it there.
And Matt is, of course, the eBay expert among us and was very, very strict about looking at the shipping costs that not all of us were. But we thank him for that.
We do.
Speaking of shipping, here's all of the objects that we had successfully won on eBay. They were all shipped to Cabinet Magazine and then sat in Sina's house for months awaiting the exhibition debut, which was in March. And the notes here are that this is our sort of prima materia of our alchemical enterprise, our hermetic wisdom hidden by the packaging.
We briefly considered not opening any of them and letting that kind of be the piece. But
I believe Mark wouldn't allow that, if I remember correctly.
No.
You were very anxious.
I was, you know.
He was like a little boy on Christmas. He just wanted to open up the presents.
I was excited.
A couple of us had knives ready to go.
I've never seen someone open packages so quickly.
So the project was centered around these seven alchemical processes, and then we needed to think about how we were going to actually physically present them in the exhibition. So the idea was to take the alchemical Althanor, this is Norton's Cosmos, and use that as an inspiration for the ultimate structure, which is then shown here. Mark and Brian are sitting there, and Brian's staring intently at, you'll see, it's basically a mini version of what you'll see out there.
Yeah, it really was a big problem as to how exactly to display the material, and this is one of our greatest questions, and we had lots of crazy ideas until I think finally the group came on this discussion of the central importance of the oven, of the stove of the alchemist, and all of the symbolic resonance that has. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, right.
Yes.
Well, here is the diagram that's been sketched by one of Robert's main inspirations, Norton, who is an alchemist a very long time ago. And we have air. We have in the middle of the Athanor, you can see, is man, homo. Then earth, air, and water kind of lined up underneath him. Above him is the heavens. And above that, I think knowledge and some things like that, and God, and some things like that.
I think can I chime in real quick?
Please.
Oftentimes people look at alchemy and they think about the alchemist is trying to make gold. And I think one of the things that was really nice, and I think in part of this, you know, when we're talking about this kind of inquiry between science and art, is that the alchemists really were trying to find enlightenment, and were trying to find God through these sciences and these arts, this exploration. Oftentimes it was, you know, a ruse to have, you know, some king pay him to finance his explorations. So when we talk about this gold, I think it's important that we just kind of note that it's about this idea of enlightenment.
I guess just to bring it back to Mildred's Lane, I think the idea of having an alchemist shack there, as Mark was describing this, you know, 92-plus-acre property, what an alchemist would sometimes be forced to do is to actually flee his country and people so that he could focus on the practice of his art in seclusion and with complete dedication and without expulsion or other sorts of kind of dissonance from people around him. And so it seems to make a lot of sense with even just us as artists saying that we're going to take 3 weeks out of our lives and come to this woods and live, you know, kind of very much in seclusion but communally, and work on a practice that really is a lot of unknowns as we were challenged by the weather and things like that. We didn't really know what was going to ultimately come out of the session. But as Mark said, we've had this great opportunity to present this work at Cabinet and now here and continue to develop our relationships as artists practicing together. So that's one of my personal favorite things about this experience.
Oh, that's our last slide.
That is our last slide.
Oh, my goodness.
Can I bring up what I find most interesting about this project is the fiscal capital being bought of these objects on eBay and then going through a cultural production, going through a gallery system, and then going back onto eBay. Like, those questions of value come up. I think that's one of the most interesting parts of this project.
Did we mention that?
No. I think one of the core ideas that we've sort of left out is that Cabinet's notion was not only would they advance us this $999, and everything had to be bought on eBay, but that the object itself had to go back onto eBay when the exhibition is finished. So this object, in the last 10 days of this exhibition, will go onto eBay and will be sold to the highest bidder. So, and what happens to that money is still a question that that I'm hoping Cabinet is going to solve. So they did a test where they put it on eBay for I think a few days or something.
I think it was a 7-day auction, and it ended at I believe $3.34.
Right,
but there was a reserve, so it didn't end up going.
I think they wanted to just test how this would actually work. So. So it wasn't advertised, and it just kind of appeared and then disappeared. So the and because also it wasn't intended to come here, that was a new development. So suddenly we could no longer sell the piece if we were going to exhibit it here. So in the last 10 days of this exhibition, it will once again go on eBay, and I don't know what's going to happen at that point.
If you want to scout the objects there up front in the just to see what the value of these actually at least were at when we bought them, there are 7 books that then specify what each object was bought for and shipped for, so that if you want to try to figure out what it's actually worth now that it's the spirit of Mildred's Lane has been placed upon it in Cabinet magazine and now here too, see what that extra value is worth.
I actually wanted to bring up or go back to what you're saying, Joey, about the idea of the transformation of value. Because if eBay is this new source for the sort of curiosities and esotericness of material culture, once you take those items and you have them physically, but then you put them into an art object and it becomes in some an art object and then goes back up into eBay being sold. I think that process in itself, the touch points of culture that change the value from physical eBay item to art, part of an art object, is very parallel to the value that we give any other sort of objects that go into a space and now it's kind of blessed as art, reified, and then sold for a value greater than its parts. And I thought that was something interesting that we got into a little bit at the talk.
Yeah,
Cabinet.
The dialogue that arises is the value for me. I mean, that's what's interesting. The fiscal part is a byproduct, or maybe it's after this experiment's done, that opens up the dialogue to greater value, but who knows what that will be at this point.
And, I mean, you know how much we spent on it, so keep that in mind.
Another thing we talked about was the transformation that happened happens at the hands of the artist being parallel to the transformation that happens at the hands of the alchemist. And what alchemists did was valued very, I think, widely. What Joey was saying before about proposing to discover how to turn lead into gold was kind of their ruse for getting funding, and their real quest for philosophic enlightenment wasn't as valued, at least by the kings. So we had a lot of discussion about that parallel in our evenings in the barn at Mildred's Lane.
So I think what we'd like to do now is just take a few questions, if possible, and then I would love to just walk you out and walk around and confront our artwork, our sculpture, our experiment, or whatever that may be. And if you have any questions about why something is in a particular place, we will try our best to dodge those. But if you have any general questions about Mildred's Lane or about this process or about any of those things, now's the time. Yes.
I mean, honestly, working together to prepare the food was as much of a collaboration as I think any of the work we did on this project. So, I mean, for me personally, it was a good experience and a good exercise in solving a problem, which in this case was making something for 20 so people to eat. But, you know, just getting used to each other and how we can work, I guess, together.
Matt and Catherine came up with a really remarkable event one day where, because so much of the food issues tend to be centralized around freshness and healthiness, and so they came up with an idea to, what maybe you should tell what you did.
We created this sort of fast food performance called McMildred's. And we created, Matt is a lover of fast food, and fast food packaging.
Packaging, not
packaging,
the food.
Packaging. I was getting to that part. That was the next part. And so having had some fast food work experience under my belt, I said, all right, let's do this. And we designed these packages for natural fries that were sweet potatoes, right? And we made vegetarian options for meat products and milkshakes, which were a big
uniforms.
Hit.
And uniforms.
We had uniforms, and our milkshakes were multicolored.
But really making slow food. I think part of it was just that we took... We made things that actually took an insane amount of preparation.
Like 2-3 hours, we would usually, all of us, no matter what meal we were planning, that would be about how long we were in the kitchen. I mean, again, feeding 20 people and trying to be deliberate about it in an artistic way, as Mark was explaining.
But, I mean, to go back to the question a little bit, I think a lot of the food stuff as well kind of, in some of the preparations, turned into performances, you know, and installations. And one of the meals was, I believe, like it was all just like white food. Everything on the
right.
table was white, you know. Or trying to think of what else. One of the fellows who's not here with us today, Scott, was kind of a fan of the peanut butter and jelly or Wendy's, and just not so into, more into mundane food. And he said, why don't we just, you know, like make some hobo packs and throw some, you know, sandwiches and just go eat on the river, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so they took cloth napkins, tied them around sticks that they harvest together, and then we all went down to the river and ate there.
Yeah, where there was also very good soup. And
there was a hobo fire a kettle of bean soup cooking over it.
But then we also ate pizza, and I'm going to interrupt you, Joey, I'm sorry. There was, I mean, but it wasn't like pizza, it was pizza with squash on it and baked beans. I don't know what else. I mean, it's what you get is kind of, because it's also the first question is, well, what's in the refrigerator today? And then what can you, it's like, oh, we got a lot of lima beans. Oh, lima beans. What do we make with lima beans?
And we do have the partnership with local organic farms, so we kind of have to take what they have.
I think to sum up what they're saying is, at least I personally believe that food is innately communal, and I think it naturally just brings that out. But the difference here is that we're putting a different kind of energy into it that turns it and transforms it into just sitting around the table and eating. It becomes this performative act, and especially as artists and as you know, collaborators, I think just doing something that we all do on an everyday basis and collaborating in a different way on that also really translates over to, you know, collaborating for this project. So it's, I think it's more, it's not just the communal activity, it's how we're collaborating in a different way than is normal with everyday cooking, I guess.
Yeah, question?
I'm fascinated by, it seems that the continual, ongoing, performative aspects of cooking today, and your comment is really for the students, but your comment earlier that spending more time beyond classroom time is essential to teaching art. Since so much of your time up there is performance, collaboration, it seems that everything, do you ever find yourself unable to drop out of the performative mode? Become more normal social animals?
I'm going to repeat the question, maybe. The question was something like, can we, there seems to be a lot of performative aspects of Mildred's Lane, and...
If I could simplify the question, is it, as it seems that a lot of your time you are actors. Are you ever able to break part?
I never felt like an actor. I wouldn't say that we felt like actors. What were you going
to
say, John?
I was just going to try to repeat the question because I was asked.
I think it was more playing than performing.
Yeah.
It was more of a being a kid and having fun cooking a silly meal than it was really being on. And I think when Mark mentioned the faculty kind of being social, I think that and even being see them with their friends, they've been friends with for a long time, it sets a casual tone to everything. To where it's not in a classroom, we're not on stage, it's just we're playing together in a sense. I never felt like pressure that I was on.
You didn't feel that you were actually engaged in theatrical performance?
I mean, I would say many of the nights there ended with us all kind of just watching, a B-horror film in the barn at Mildred's Lane, and with an alcoholic beverage of one's choosing, and just kind of relaxing and talking. And I think in that way, it's like, I never felt like we were doing anything but honestly engaging with each other.
I think that there are Saturdays are public events where people from the community and people from anywhere can drop by, and those are open, and there literally can be as many as 150 people at those at a time. So, but we're still not acting in a sense, even though we're kind of participating in the construction of the meal and the construction of the event. I think it's more. I don't know. I wouldn't say it's as performative in a way.
I think it's also like trying to act purposefully, and trying to act purposefully in a reason for a reason that you want, instead of a reason that, like, if I'm in school, the reason that I'm performing the way that I'm reasoning in some way is dictated by either the structure of the school or the grade that I'm getting or all those things. If I'm shopping, with the performative aspect of that, I'm playing a consumer. When we transfer that to some place that's outside of both of those, the performative aspect is trying to figure out what that... I mean, it's something different. I mean, I'm not saying that there are times where we are performing by serving meals or this thing is a public Saturday or people are giving lectures or there are these things that are not normal normal places. But when you're sitting next to somebody around a fire, like you're just sitting next to someone by the fire, one night when Joey and I heard a weird noise in the woods, and we still don't know exactly what that was.
Werewolf.
I mean,
but I think one of the things that you might be getting at is their kind of personal time, and in a way, not really. It's really three full-on weeks, and that's kind of what you sign up for.
And it's 20. It really is 24/7.
I mean, I actually have a schedule here if you want to hear it.
We would.
You want to hear it at all? Anyone interested in this?
But it was great because we would stay up like very very late, frequently, and then be up very very early for a 9 a.m. lecture on sculpture in the expanded field, for example. But as much as that was would seem taxing, it was saturating in a way that was energizing. And it just, everything just kind of carried over into the next day and the next day and the next day. And I felt like I dropped out of time in so many words. And the fact that it was a three-week experience, by the first 4 days, all of us were remarking how we felt like we had known each other for a very long time and that we had probably already been there for 4 weeks, but it was just 4 days.
Extending beyond just the campus itself, I think everything at Mildred's Lane is structured to be kind of an indelible experience in one way or another, and regardless if you found it positive or negative. And I think there's a kind of a tendency for people who have gone through it to want to promote the place, just as an idea, as a place, and especially involved with a project like this, given the opportunity to do that, it's kind of something you feel like you want to do. And it's something that I think everybody, certainly here, is, you know, taking time out of their busy schedules to be here and promote this project and Mildred's Lane. And I think that's pretty consistent throughout the sessions and the people that I've met having gone through that place.
Other questions?
Based on your descriptions of your experiences, they sound idyllic, joyful, like you were living in a artist's utopia, especially in contradiction to the popular models we have of like how someone lives as an artist, either like a solo genius or they're employed by a design firm or something. But I want to know, like, were you guys a democracy? How did you govern yourself? Were there major things that tore you apart? That, like, is there a dark side to the, like,
the dark matter?
I guess it was a...
What's that?
I guess the question was whether there's a dark side to Mildred's Lane, maybe. I would... Maybe I can say... Answer that a little bit in saying it felt like a benign... dictatorship, maybe, with Morgan at the head.
Don't blame it for Morgan.
And there's a lot. I mean, kind of what maybe implied in a lot of these slides and our talks is that there's a lot of work involved. I mean, it's a large property. The projects are really ambitious each session, and just having, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20 people on campus, getting them to be fed can be a major chore, and I think there's major efforts to make that an enjoyable experience, an experience that you can take something from afterwards, that, you know, there's a lot of work involved, a lot of hauling rocks.
You know, because, yeah, I was actually going to mention that, is, I mean, most of the weekday mornings, we just moved kind of heavy rocks, either in the burning sun or in pouring rain, and, I mean, just to get the project going, so... Definitely, I think, you know, I don't think anybody felt restricted being there, but there was certainly a lot of work involved, and just, like was kind of mentioned, it's a large place, and you just have to get things done, and they're not always easy to accomplish, you know.
In terms of the part of the question about was it a democracy, if we had any sort of form of social organization, it would happen in the times that we were doing specific chores, like moving rocks. There would be a group doing that. There would be a group digging a ditch. There would be the pair that's working together to organize dinner. And whereas, you know, one might think of those as chores, yes, they were physical labor and tiring at times, what those things did is they allowed us to actually build relationships with each other and have these kind of breakaway times where we could talk about our own art practices and things tangential to the lecture we might be having in the afternoon. So I felt like that those opportunities just led themselves into an easier way to collaborate. So there wasn't really a particular, I think, form of self-governance, but just more of exploration with each other, and those kind of things made it for glue with us.
There's a reason that the other fellows aren't here.
I gotta say, it is very exhausting, but it's really exciting. I mean, you gotta remember, I mean, and first off, I mean, I know a couple people that have done this in different sessions, and they all had great experiences. But I personally am very, very lucky because every single one of these fellows are incredible people. And I know we've all kind of like hit it off right off the bat. And I think that may be part of like where the idealism kind of comes from in a sense. But we're also really young artists who are super excited to just participate. like, it's a luxury for us. Like, we're still very young and, like, have a lot of energy. So I think there's a certain amount of naivety is not the word, because it is functional and it helpful to be doing this kind of laborious stuff. But we're going in there with this attitude of, like, hey, so what's your work like? We're moving rocks and we're talking about things, and we're, you know. And I think that attitude is kind of self-filtering of like what brought all of us there, especially at such an early stage in Mildred's Lane, where it is young. There's not a whole lot of knowledge out there for us, like many of us prior to, you know, to coming there and stuff. And so I think that kind of sets the bar to open us up for an experience like this to really make it very fruitful.
In a session like this, too, everyone was there with the idea of being a part of the Alchemist Shack project. And I think we all had the common bond of being there to work on this this project. And I think it really can't be understated, the enthusiasm that Robert, Mark, and Morgan had for this project and all the projects throughout the during the different sessions at Mildred's Lane. So that it's you feel like you are being part of something, and that's an incredible motivator on things like moving rocks.
And I mean, I would definitely say that aside from Morgan being kind of the queen monarch of the whole place, I feel like within the group, it was to answer your original question, it was actually very democratic. And aside from the occasional steering by Mark and Robert to get us into a certain direction, but I mean, I feel that everybody moved rocks, you know, and that was nice.
We did more than move rocks. Someone say that on record.
We did some
we
things
did a lot
besides
more than
move rocks.
John wants me to say.
You know, I think for myself, what's really important about this program and what's important about the motivation behind it is, you know, I went to school I studied art in the early 80s, and classes never really ended. So you would have a 3-hour seminar with Craig Owens or Joseph Kosuth, and then after that seminar, it would be dinner time, and you'd all go to the diner together. And then after the diner, it'd be like, okay, who wants a drink? And you would go to the pub together. And then it would be about 11 or 12, and it would be, the clubs are opening. Who wants to go out? And you would go to the clubs. And then it would be 4 or 5, and it would be, who's coming back to my place for a nightcap? And then you would do that. And that just doesn't happen very often in art schools now. And,
how do you remember that?
And I know this because I last year had to do some lecturing at University of Pennsylvania and in State College, and I had to sign a contract, and that contract said that I would not fraternize with students beyond the classroom or lecture hall. And I thought, you know, I really don't know how you can teach art that way, because all of those other sites were pedagogic sites. In art school, as far as I know, the pub is as much a pedagogic site as the lecture hall. And so in some way, this is a very conscious way of trying to get back that social time that artists need to learn the practice of making art. And that really has to happen somewhere outside of that classroom as well. And it has to happen with the establishment of a kind of a trust where it's very hard. There are no rules to how you make it in the art world. There are no rules to what things work, what things make sense. You need to have someone you trust to talk through those things with. And that never will happen. That never happens in the classroom. So this is really, for me, a kind of pedagogic model of how to reestablish that in a somewhat structured way.
And I think what Mark is saying also goes back to answer the question of whether there's a dark side to Mildred's Lane. Like, have we ever felt like, oh, I've been moving rocks, like, for 3 days straight, I'm not learning anything, or, you know, if that thought hit us, or, like, we're, you know, I'm just getting so sick of these people, like, I just want to leave, you know, not that either of us really ever considered those things, but if we felt like, you know, maybe it was taking too much out of us or asking too much of us, what Mark and Morgan and the other teachers put into it always goes far beyond what we even know. I mean, just the dedication that Mark and the rest of them have to us as students and to really making the project real, making our learning experiences true, and letting us discover things that they don't even plan for us to discover. That commitment is so deep and intuitive to them that it never. I really don't think that there is a dark core. I think that the core is like definitely love, actually.
Should we go look at the work in the other room?
Yeah.